Welcome to Calcutta University, Domingo Hills. We are at the SBS 318 Islamic Culture and Civilization course. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan. We're coming live to you from Calcutta University, live on television locally in Los Angeles and globally on the internet. Today we are dealing with session 9 of 13 on Islamic culture and civilization, and we are busy with the very bedrock of the course, the very fundamental theme of the course, which is Islamic civilization. And last week we did part 1 of Islam's contribution to global civilization, and today in the first portion of this program, the first hour and a half or two, we hope to conclude that section on Islam's contribution to global civilizations. I have two guests today with me, and I hope you'll really enjoy today's program, and as informative as last week, and perhaps even more so. Last week, we somewhat concluded with quotations by great and outstanding scholars of history regarding the contribution of Islam to the global civilization, and how Islamic culture and civilization was a form of a catalyst for the Renaissance in Europe, which ushered in the modern age. In one of his writings, Professor John Hayes, in his book, The Genius of Arab Civilization, A Source of Renaissance, he said, and I quote, "One of the hallmarks of civilized people is knowledge of the past, including the past of others with whom one's own culture has had repeated and fruitful contact, or the past of any group that has contributed to the ascent of man." The Arabs fit profoundly into both of the latter two categories, but in the West, the Arabs are not well known, victims of ignorance as well as misinformation. They and their culture have often been stigmatized from afar. Now, to make very clear this concept of Arab culture and Arab civilization, I think somewhat, in some degree, may be misconstrued as dealing with an ethnic group. Rather, I wish to clarify that from a quote by Professor Robert Briefold in his book, Making of Humanity, which we quoted last week and I think appropriate here for us as an opener. He said, "Although there is no single aspect of European growth in which the decisive influence of Islamic culture is not traceable, nowhere is it so clear and momentous as in the genesis of that power which constitute the permanent distinctive force of the modern world, that is, the natural science and scientific spirit." Professor Hitti then emphasizes this issue of the scientific spirit with the Islamic ethos rather than a cultural or an ethnic ethos. He says, and I quote Philip K. Hitti in his book, Short History of the Arabs, he says, "During all the first part of the Middle Ages, no other people made as important a contribution to human progress as did the Arabs. If we take the term Arabs to mean all those whose mother tongue was Arabic, and not merely those living in the Arabian Peninsula. For centuries, Arabic was the language of learning, of culture, and intellectual progress for the whole of the civilized world, with the exception of the Far East. From the 9th to the 12th centuries, there were more philosophical, medical, historical, religious, astronomical, and geographical works written in Arabic than in any other human tongue." Now, this brings us to the question as to how is it that Islam, that originated or flourished or initiated or was initiated in a desert area of the Middle East and Arabia, was able to be such a catalyst for the science and for global civilization. I think we need to look very carefully at how Islam approaches the question of nature in itself. A large portion of the Islamic text, divine text, according to Muslim belief, the Quran, deals with nature directly or indirectly. In most cases, very directly. Nature, of course, or the nature of nature, according to Islamic thought, is determined by some of the following: createdness, orderliness, and purposiveness. By createdness, we mean that the idea of nature in Islam, nature in itself, is seen as the after as the effect of God's will in operation. So nature is the will of God in operation, and nature itself is a kind of the creature of God, or the expression of the createdness of God, of the creativity of God, or of that which God has created. Orderliness. Islam holds nature to be orderly, and therefore there is the entire scientific approach of cause and effect. Event occurs as a result of its cause. Nature, therefore, seems to be a complete order, a manifestation of a complete and orderly order. And because all events follow the same basic general natural laws, nothing stands outside it or beyond it except the Creator. And then the issue of purposiveness. Each of the objects that constitute nature has been assigned a specific post or a position or a role. And therefore we find even references in the Quran to the fact that everything is created according to measure with a distinct purpose and a distinct role. We have witnessed and noticed one of the quotations which I have read from Robert Briefholt, in which he said about the fact that there's not a single aspect of European growth in which the decisive influence of Islamic culture is not traceable. Nowhere is it so clear, he said, and momentous as in the genesis of that power which constitutes the permanent distinctive force of the modern world and the supreme source of its victory, natural science and the scientific spirit. Robert Briefholt, In the Making of Humanity. Now, the cultivation of Islamic sciences depended upon a vast educational system which embraced both formal and informal education, and which made possible the encouragement and transmission of knowledge in all its forms. There was no dichotomy between the so-called religious and secular learning. Learning was learning, for all knowledge, it's believed in Islamic philosophy, leads to the ultimate truth, and knowledge is a pursuit of truth. The educational system, were of course, based on traditional Islamic concepts of knowledge and learning in those days. It emphasized most of all the religious sciences, but also included nearly all other forms of knowledge from theodicy to pharmacology. Islam's consideration of knowledge as something sacred, because ultimately all knowledge concerns some aspect of God's creation. It is this sacred view of knowledge that has imbued the whole Islamic educational system to this day, making it even institutionally inseparable from specific religious organizations and institutions such as the mosque. This view has made the relation between the teacher and the student of traditional schools of most intimate and spiritual one, and teachers have enjoyed a reverence hardly imaginable in modern society. The whole affair of education has always been at the heart of Islamic civilization. From its inception, the mosque of the Prophet in Medina has been a center of prayer, and we dealt an entire program with the role of mosques a few weeks ago. I think it was session 5 or 6, where we dealt with the role of the mosque and its centrality as an axis of the believing community and the central piece in the Islamic society, and how it contributed to the development of the community, to the cohesiveness of the community, for the empowerment of the community, and for a place of expressing solidarity, and also as a symbol of the presence of Islam. And from the outset, you would find the Prophet's mosque in Medina was always meant to be not only a place of worship, but also a place of learning, a place of hiring one's understanding, and of course of empowering oneself, as well as many other dimensions of social existence which it addressed. The whole affair of education has always been at the heart of Islamic civilization. One of its basic pillars has been the idea that knowledge is obligatory upon all people of faith. And therefore, the idea of knowledge and faith has always been inseparable in Muslim thought, and therefore the idea of science and religion, there was never a war or a clash between the two. A short snippet from the CNN will give us some indication as to the beginnings of Islam by Professor Esposito, making reference to the beginnings of Islam and how, for example, the Quran and the prophetic traditions led to the development and it was an impetus for the growth of Islamic thought and Islamic civilization and also of knowledge in general. Let's have a look at the CNN snippet.
The result, according to Islam, a message from God dictated in Arabic that would eventually become their holy scripture, the Quran, literally the recitation.
That Muslims do believe that this is the literal word of God, that every word in this book comes directly, as it were, from God. But because it's the literal word of God does not mean that it is a literalist interpretation all of the time.
That word and the religion that sprung from it spread across three continents over the centuries that followed. At the time, the Islamic world was an oasis of civilization and learning.
During the Dark Ages, they became the builders and the purveyors of civilization and culture. And after that, passed that on to the West, whether it was philosophy, algebra, geometry, medicine, the sciences, the arts, architecture. And this is part of the kind of memory, politically and culturally, of many Muslims.
That was Professor John Esposito from Georgetown University speaking on CNN regarding Islam and the development of Islam and, of course, the contribution of Islamic scholars and learning to civilization as a whole, which is the theme of our discussion this evening. Now, with the continuous development of the Islamic sciences, new branches and forms of science came into being. And at the same time, the sciences which were taken over from the pre-Islamic civilizations were somewhat Islamized and fitted into the Islamic hierarchy of knowledge. Both these tendencies are reflected in the later schemes of classification to which dozens of separate treaties or chapters have been devoted by such masters as Ibn Sina, Al-Ghazali, and Ibn Rushd, some scholars which we'll be dealing with later this evening. And even by a remarkable historian of the 14th century, Ibn Khaldun, who in his Muqaddama, or the Prolegomena to the General Study of History, gave an elaborate account of the classification of the Islamic sciences after its period of maturity. Now, regarding the centers of Islamic learning, don't forget the attachment of the mosque to the school, or the school to the mosque. It very often happened that mosques had sections, specific sections, which were for schooling, and there were schools which had particular sections which were for prayer. So the idea of the mosque and the school or the madrasa, a place of learning, has been inseparable, something we dealt with last week somewhat. The centers in which the Islamic sciences have been taught over the ages have been an integral aspect of Islamic civilization, particularly in the early period and what we call the Middle Ages. Participating in its formal unity in the same way that the content of the sciences became integrated into the all-embracing intellectual unity of the Islamic philosophy. From the beginning, the mosque was at once the religious and the social center of the Islamic community, as well as the center of learning, as well as the center of training and for training. And to this day, Quranic schools, where the fountainhead of all the Islamic sciences, namely the Quran, is taught to the very young, are still connected in most localities to mosques in various parts of the world. But historically, they gradually developed a distinctive institution, which I refer to the madrasa, which became virtually an independent institution. Madrasa meaning literally the place for lessons or the place for learning. Dars in Arabic meaning a class or a teaching and so on. So madrasa, the place of learning or the place where teaching is conveyed. We found that there was a growing madrasa system next to an established mosque. And very often these became very elaborate structures, sometimes much larger than the mosque. In fact, in most cases, like in the case of Al-Azhar in Egypt, in Kairouan, in Morocco, in Tunisia, in Timbuktu, for example, in West Africa, in Baghdad, in Samarkand, in Central Asia, Baghdad, in Iraq, in Isfahan, in Qum, Najaf, Mashhad, in Lahore, in Pakistan, and so on and so forth, in many parts of the world, in Nadwa, in India, and so on. So the development of the madrasa, which grew alongside the mosque, and is still today closely associated with it. As teaching became formalized and extended, buildings were often erected specifically for the teaching purposes with mosques attached to them. In either case, however, both architecturally and intellectually, the mosque and the madrasa have never been dissociated from each other, and some of the greatest Muslim centers of learning, such as Al-Azhar in Egypt, are even now both mosques and schools, reflecting the profoundly religious character of learning in Islam. The madrasa developed into a full-fledged jami'ah, or a place of learning a variety of subjects or topics, a combination of colleges, so jami'ah, a gathering from the word jama'ah in Arabic, which means to gather, a gathering of learning, and you have the establishment of the first full-fledged universities in North and West Africa, which are still in existence today. So when the madrasa, some of them developed into full-fledged universities, and this was around 1100 years ago, a university in which a variety of subjects from religious law to astronomy were taught regularly. And some of the earliest Islamic educational institutions dating from this period of Genesis, in fact, still survive. The best examples I have mentioned are Qarawayin in Fez, the Zaytuna Institute in Tunis, Al-Azhar in Cairo, Qum and Mashhad in Iran, Samarkand in Central Asia, Najaf in Iraq, Sana'a in Yemen, Lucknow in India, and Cordova, of course, not in Muslim rule at the moment, nor a center of Islamic learning, but was in its early days. And all of these belong to the earlier period of Islamic history, but were always profoundly connected to the early madrasa. Now, in dealing with the centers of learning, there are two centers that I wish to emphasize somewhat this week. The second one will be Baghdad, of which you will see a snippet later on, but now I will be dealing with in West Africa, what is today Mali. One of the greatest seats of Islamic learning was in Timbuktu, and though it sounds like a proverbial place which is referred to in a joking form, Timbuktu indeed has been a center, was a center of learning, and Timbuktu is in present-day Mali in West Africa. And there we have a beautiful mosque, a beautiful shot of the Sankore Mosque in Timbuktu in West Africa, which till today is a major mosque as well as center of learning. Now, Muslim travelers, most notably Ibn Battuta and Hassan al-Wazan, also called Leo Africanus, were no less eager to visit cities from all over the world, but more specifically cities of learning or cities where they had centers of learning. And among the most celebrated of these places has been Timbuktu in Mali. Timbuktu was a starting point for every African pilgrims, for West African pilgrims going to the Hajj, and a center, some of the finest of Islamic scholarship in the Middle Ages. Next week, hopefully God willing, I'll be dealing with Islam in America, Islam through Africa into America. And it's from this West African part of the world that slaves were brought here, many of them Muslims, and how Islam arrived on the soil of Africa, soil of America from Africa, and the presence of Islam for a couple of centuries already in this part of the world in America, having come originally from Africa. So we're dealing with Timbuktu, and this is the part of West Africa from where some of the slaves in that area, from where the slaves came from Gambia and so on, which is very close to Mali itself. Now, Mali or Timbuktu is set on the Islamic world's southwestern edge. Timbuktu was the product of an eclectic mixture of West African and Arab influence that found in Islam a common denominator. Barely two centuries after its founding in around 1100, Timbuktu earned its reputation as one of the most important centers of Islamic learning ever and the most important center of Islamic learning in West Africa. At its height, during the mid-16th century, this city had a population of over 60,000 and it was a prime caravan stop for people traveling through the desert. According to tariqs, which is an Arabic word also used in West Africa, referring to history. The word tariq means history. According to the narratives and traditions of West Africans, Timbuktu's religious leaders, judges, and officials all tended to be graduates of the city's illustrious school. And in this city, where the study of Islamic principles was regarded as of supreme importance. The historian Al-Wazan found a great store of doctors, judges, priests and other learned men and women in that part of the world. By the mid-16th century, the so-called golden age of Timbuktu, the city boasted well over 150 schools. Timbuktu in the 16th century, 150 schools in that part of West Africa. Only when religious and linguistic literacy has been achieved was a student assigned to a particular mentor. In other words, the standard of learning was of a very, very high quality and even excelled some of those in the Middle East or even in North Africa. The relationship between pupil and master in Timbuktu often grew to be a strong one, and a student might work under a teacher for a while as an apprentice or secretary in order to enhance his or her education. And as the community grew, an intellectual genealogy developed, similar to those acknowledged elsewhere in the Islamic world. And this linked the master to the pupil, the teacher to the pupil, and those pupil to their own students. Strong academic and religious ties with other scholastic centers of Middle East and North Africa linked Timbuktu to the rest of the Islamic world. As the numbers of students increased, so did the fields of study available. Subjects such as world history, mathematics, astronomy, cartography, in time joined the wealth of courses available in Timbuktu in the mid-16th century. Although Timbuktu prided itself on the rigor of his teaching for even the youngest pupils, visiting traders or travelers were encouraged to enroll where they stayed in the city. Thus, many non-Muslim merchants embraced Islam in Timbuktu through encounters with Muslim scholars. Even older visitors could be assured that the city's scholastic community would educate them. Indeed, there was a saying in Timbuktu that went that whosoever had endured the hardship of the journey to this city has earned himself a scholarship. The people of Timbuktu were reputed to be so philanthropic that they would afford any visitor an education regardless of his or her means. Thus, at the height of the city's golden age, Timbuktu boasted not only the impressive libraries of Sankore and the mosque which you see in the background, but also a wealth of private libraries. To give an indication, in the mid-16th century, a scholar by the name of Haji Ahmad bin Omar had in his private collection 700 original manuscripts in Arabic of 22 different fields of science and learning. 700 volumes in his private collection. And he himself copied and annotated a considerable number of these volumes. As late as the close of the 19th century, Dr. Felix Dubois purchased a number of antique books in Timbuktu, including a copy of the Divan of Kings, a chronology of the rulers and events of Sudan between 1656 and 1747. But the madrasa was far from being the only center, madrasa meaning the schools attached to the mosque or near the mosque. Madrasa being, as I mentioned early on, a place of learning, or a school, a common name for a school in Arabic. The madrasa was far from being the only center of study or for the transmission of the sciences. Hospitals, for example, played an important educational role, and many of the leading hospitals, such as those of Ray in Persia and Baghdad in the 4th or the 10th century, had medical schools attached to them with regular programs for students. Medical dissertations had to be written by those who wanted to receive their medical certificate. The traditional hospital had been throughout Islamic history a major scientific institution, combining the curing of patients with extensive teaching of medicine, pharmacology, and allied subjects. Another important scientific institution which complemented the hospital and in which both research and teaching took place is the observatory. In fact, it can be said without exaggeration that the observatory as a scientific institution owes its birth to Islamic civilization. While in the early Islamic period, the observatory was of small size, like for example, the one in Marghash Observatory, which was run by Nasiruddin al-Tusi in Persia, it became a major scientific institution in which numerous scientists gathered to work and to teach together. The formal and public institutions of learning so far mentioned, that is the madrasa, the hospitals, and the observatories, however, are not the only ones to consider when discussing the importance of centers for the teaching and the transmission of Islamic sciences. Much or rather of sciences in Islam or in the Muslim world, much of this of the transmission of learning, especially of the more esoteric knowledge, has taken place and continues to take place in private circles, which are called khanqas in Persian or zawiya in Arabic. And these are more spiritual oriented. And thus we find that they served a function both of training in ideology and philosophy and also in spirituality as well. So we can see that from the outset, from the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, throughout, as long as the Muslims were in authority and in power and in charge of their education and institutions, and the governments, you found there was a flowering of Islamic learning, a flowering of sciences in general, and an ability to contribute tremendously to the various fields of sciences and civilization. We are now going to take a snippet from Islam, the Empire of Faith, an excellent PBS documentary on Islam, A Thousand Years of Faith. Islam is called Islam, an Empire of Faith, and where we look at Baghdad as one center. And there, of course, were many. There was Samarkand in Russia, there was Ray, there was Baghdad in Iraq, as which we are going to see, Cairo, Timbuktu, Nadwa in India, and of course, Lahore in Pakistan, and in various parts of the world, Sana'a in Yemen. But we are going to look specifically at Baghdad, and thereafter we're going to invite our guest, Brother Munir from last week, who will continue the discussion from last week to conclude the section on Islam's contribution to global civilization. We now go to Islam, the Empire of Faith.
For centuries, Islam had extended its reach from Spain all the way to the edge of India. It took nearly a year to travel from one end of the Arab Empire to the other. At its heart was a fabled city of wealth. It was called Baghdad. The palaces of ancient Baghdad have been lost over the centuries. But in its glory, it rivaled ancient Athens or Rome. It was a magnificent architectural achievement, the pride of Islam in a new age. One visitor left this account. All the exquisite neighborhoods covered with parks, gardens, villas, and beautiful promenades are filled with bazaars and finely built mosques and baths. They stretch for miles on both sides of the glittering river. But what made this the greatest city of its time was more than just what met the eye. It was the company it kept. Scholars made Baghdad the jewel of the world.
Certainly from the 8th century on, Baghdad was the center of learning in the Islamic world, and all major innovations either came from Baghdad or quickly came to Baghdad because the best people came to Baghdad, the best thinkers, the best philosophers, the best artists.
They came in search of answers to pragmatic questions. The empire's meteoric growth had left its new leaders overwhelmed. They had staggering engineering and logistical problems to contend with. Solving them would take the greatest minds of the day.
Under the new empire now, you are responsible for public hygiene, you are responsible for the marketplace, you are responsible for goods being sold in the marketplace. All of those require some basic elementary sciences. This new civilization, having a need for science, really stems from the need to run that empire.
The best minds rose to the call. The finest were welcomed at a center of scholarship, Baghdad's renowned House of Wisdom.
It was a magnet for scholars and intellectuals who came and worked in the academies. There were public libraries associated with the palace, and scholars came from all over the empire. And there were scholars from Iran, there were scholars from Byzantium who came. Some were Christians, some were Muslims, some were Jews. And all of these different sort of threads of human knowledge came together in the city of Baghdad.
So the net effect of this is that you've got human individuals from radically different cultural traditions being thrown into the same crucible.
The challenge that greeted these scholars was daunting. The great works of the ancients had to be transformed into a wholly new body of knowledge. Competition for jobs developed within a new intellectual elite.
And from there on, every single scientist is competing for that job. They were competing among themselves almost just in the same way that modern bureaucrats and modern academicians will fight among themselves.
Scholars were dispatched across the empire to locate as many ancient texts as possible. The first international scientific venture in history. Unlike their Christian counterparts, Muslim thinkers saw no insurmountable contradiction between their faith and the laws governing the natural world. So they embraced Aristotle and Plato, writers the Christian church considered blasphemous.
So this is the time when we begin to see scientists, bureaucrats, what have you, going and seeking from whatever civilization that had any sciences before, be it the Greek, be it the Indian, being the Persian, and so on.
From the Hindus came mathematical concepts that guide us today. It was the scholars of the House of Wisdom who developed the system of Arabic numerals, still in use. It is they who translated and transformed the writings of the Greeks and made a gift of them to the modern Western world. The Renaissance had its beginnings in Baghdad.
They managed to assimilate quite a lot of the rich legacy of the Hellenistic world, translated into Arabic initially, which was then made available to all other participants in the new Islamic civilization. Arabic emerges as the language of learning throughout the region. This is a very significant development in human intellectual history.
Having amassed the knowledge, the Muslims now began to challenge it. This was perhaps their most important contribution. The scientific process was born.
They wanted to know why a very intelligent Greek scientist, whose text they were just admiring and they were verifying it, why would he make a mistake in the first place? So they began to dig. Was it because he didn't have the right instruments, or is it because he didn't have the right methodology to use the instruments for the verifications of observation? It is this spirit. You see, the spirit of questioning, the spirit of saying that we have to build science constantly on a systematic, consistent basis, where we make a physical proposition of how the universe ought to be run, and the mathematical representation of that physical universe ought to match. Now you begin to have what I call the birth of the new Islamic science.
Algebra and trigonometry, engineering and astronomy, countless disciplines integral to our lives today trace their roots to Islamic scientists. More surprising, perhaps, were their innovations in medicine. At a time when Europeans were praying to the bones of their saints to cure their illnesses, Muslim physicians developed an innovative theory that disease was transmitted through tiny airborne organisms, the precursor to the study of germs. They determined that sick patients should be quarantined and then treated. This is the basis of the institution most fundamental to medicine today, the hospital.
That was from Islam, the Empire of Faith, and we saw there how the mosque is the center of learning, and they were referring to Baghdad and Baitul Hikmah in particular, as well as reference to the schools and the scholars, the growing of science and the development thereof, translation of various works, as well as, of course, the development of the hospitals there towards the end of that snippet. I just wish to begin with a quote here by George Sarton, and his book, Introduction to the History of Science. He says, it will suffice here to evoke a few glorious names without contemporary equivalents in the West. Jafar ibn Hayyan, Jabir ibn Hayyan, Al-Kindi, Al-Khawarizmi, Al-Farghani, Al-Razi, Thabit ibn Qurra, Al-Battani, Hunayn ibn Ishaq, Al-Farabi, Ibrahim ibn Sinan, Al-Mas'udi, Al-Tabari, Abu al-Wafa, Ali ibn Abbas, Abu al-Qasim, Ibn al-Jazzar al-Biruni, Ibn Sina, Ibn Yunus, Al-Kashi, Ibn al-Haytham, Al-Ghazali, Umar Khayyam. A magnificent array of names which it would not be difficult to extend. If anyone tells you that the Middle Ages were scientifically sterile, just quote these names to them. This is George Sarton in his book, Introduction to the History of Science. By the way, some of the scholars that he mentioned here with Arabic names, who studied in Arabic and under the patronage of the Arab caliphs at that time, or caliphs or khalifs, were not Muslim, by the way. So I would like the listeners, if there are any of you who could identify that amongst these Arab names which I have mentioned, or these scholars that I've mentioned, if any of them or some of them were non-Muslim, maybe Christian or Jewish, and I would like you to see if you can respond to that, or find up, check it up, and see if any one of them, certainly to a tip, at least one of them, if not more than that, that I identify myself as having been Christian and one Jewish. Today, our guest from last week, continuation as we are dealing with Islam's contribution to global civilization, today is part two. And last week, we were honored to have with us Brother Munir Sheikh, who's pursuing his PhD in Islamic Studies at UCLA and has been before on this program, someone who we have enjoyed and from whom we have learned tremendously. And welcome, Brother Munir.
Thank you for having me back another time. It's a great opportunity.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's great to have you.
Very enjoyable.
Thank you very much. It's such a tremendous response about our program last week. And I mentioned that I may have you on for this week as well. And, demand, I suppose. When you've got it, you've got it, I suppose. Thank you very much, Munir, for coming and for sharing with us, your information and your knowledge and your expertise. I wish to look at some of the major Muslim scholars that have contributed towards the global civilization. These are by no means necessarily the best of them all, certainly amongst them, but we're looking at various fields. Sometimes in medicine, there are about 10, 12 of them which were outstanding, unparalleled in history. Sure. So we may choose one of them, for example, or maybe two at most. They are geographers, explorers, they're historians. In fact, I was looking at possibly having 10 names, and Ibn Khaldun is such a major figure, and I didn't even include him, for example. So, I mean...
He could take a program just for himself.
Program for himself, yes. One of the people I wish to look at, for example, look at very early in the Islamic history, when we talk about people like Imam Shafi, who was a great scholar, and Abu Hanifa, and Malik, and so on, the great jurists of Islam. Mm-hmm. And who contributed tremendously and were very influential in the lives of other scholars who may not necessarily have been so-called religious scholars. Shafi, of course, one of the masters of Islamic jurisprudence. He's called the father of Islamic jurisprudence, in fact. He himself was a student of Nafisa binti Hassan, which was a great granddaughter of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and of course of Ali and Fatima, descendant, and he had Imam Shafi was a Palestinian. He studied in Mecca, he studied in Medina, he studied in Baghdad, which we have just seen now. Also ended up in Egypt, where he eventually died and lies buried. But just by way of introduction, this Nafisa, when I was in Cairo, I used to attend go to the mosque. Mm-hmm. Peaceful place called Nafisa Tul Ilm. Her title is the Nafisa, the Leonard One. Mm-hmm. Could you maybe shed some light on the fact that, that sometimes when you look at history, whether it be Islamic or otherwise, very often you find that, although the times may have been such, I don't know, but very rarely do you find acknowledgement of scholarship of the females in some of the questioner last week asked, to which we responded. But could you perhaps maybe elaborate on that as an opening remark?
Sure. Well, I think the issue of women scholars generally is a very interesting one, and one that has not been really investigated to the degree that it should be, although there are more and more people interested today, scholars and historians who are looking back at various documents and trying to reconstruct the history of the Muslim community in its fullest sense, which would of course include Muslim women scholars and women who participate in other spheres of activity, whether that's in politics or in education generally, maybe not as researchers but as instructors, or women who were physicians or who were in various other trades and crafts. And what this particular figure, Nafisa, represents is the status of women scholars in early Islam, particularly when, right after the time of the Prophet Muhammad, women had achieved a significant prominence in the community as bearers of the teachings of the Prophet and transmitters of those teachings, whether it be as reciters of Quran or whether it be as memorizers of hadith, transmitters of hadith, and simply wise people to whom various people who were interested in learning about the teachings of Islam would approach and sit with in order to get their knowledge and wisdom. And certainly there were many, many other figures besides Nafisa. The challenge is to go back, as I said, and find out that information. One of the ways in which scholars do that is through investigating a particular genre of literature, which is known as the biographical dictionary. Mm-hmm. And this is a very unique category of history writing among Muslims. So in that respect, this is a particular type of document. And these documents list generation by generation a series of scholars based on city or based on a geographic area, there would be a lineage of scholars and as much biographical information about those scholars. What we found is that there are sections and chapters of these biographical dictionaries which do list the women who have contributed in various ways. And so this is very significant. And one of the reasons why we have not had the benefit thus far of that history, women's history, or a fuller history of society, is that obviously all societies or most societies have been very patriarchal up until the present time. And that's true in Europe, it's true in China, it's true in India, it's true in generally across the planet. And so those people who have been the ones who have written history for the most part have been men, and their concerns and their interests have been primarily focused on the achievements of their colleagues, and their cultural perceptions are such that men made the important decisions or innovations. And the same might be said for American history, for example. Today we're looking at our own history as a nation and realizing that beyond Betsy Ross and beyond some of these other figures, there are some significant women who have played important roles. So it's a very similar and parallel process. The important thing to know is that indeed women did play an important role.
I think it's partly a betrayal of our own history. For any community or any nation or people, if you don't fully appreciate the various contributors, because then you undermine or blot out a particular dimension.
Sure.
Thank you very much for that. One of the people that we are going to look at is Jabir ibn Hayyan. And we have chosen about 10 scholars which we are looking at. The one Nafisa, we dealt somewhat, Nafisa bint Hassan. And the other scholars looking at Jabir ibn Hayyan is one of them. And I just wish to read a few points, and then I would like you to comment on some of the information that I put forward to you. Jabir ibn Hayyan, or known as Geber in the West, is regarded as the father of modern chemistry. His name was Abu Musa Jabir ibn Hayyan, sometimes called Al-Harrani or Al-Sufi. He was the son of a what they call Attar. Attar is a one who deals with perfume, but actually it's a druggist. He practiced medicine and alchemy in Kufa around 776, Kufa was in Iraq, and he studied under Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, one of the scholars of Islam. And of course it also shows from the outset the idea that in Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq's class there was Abu Hanifa, who was a great Judaist, and in the same class there was Jabir ibn Hayyan, the father of modern chemistry, which indicates there was no dichotomy between so-called religious and secular learning from the outset.
Sure.
So that's an important point maybe you could look at. And he practiced medicine under the patronage of the Abbasid Khalif of Harun al-Rashid. Jabir's major contribution was in the field of chemistry. He introduced experimental investigation into alchemy, which rapidly changed his character into what we call modern chemistry. His fame rests on over 100 monumental treatises, of which 22 relate to chemistry and alchemy. He wrote over 100 monumental treatises, of which 22 relate to chemistry and alchemy. His contribution of fundamental importance to chemistry includes perfection of scientific techniques such as crystallization, distillation, sublimation, and evaporation, and development of several instruments for the same. The fact of early development of chemistry as a distinct branch of science by him is well established. And the very name chemistry, of course, is derived from the Arabic word al-kimiya, which was studied and developed extensively by Jabir ibn Hayyan. His major practical achievement was the discovery of mineral and other acids, which he prepared for the first time in his alembic, or embic in Latin. Apart from several contributions of basic nature to alchemy, involving largely the preparation of new compounds and the development of chemical methods, he also developed a number of applied chemical processes, thus becoming a pioneer in the field of applied science. His achievements in the field include preparation of various metals, development of steel, dyeing of cloth and tanning of leather, lettering in gold, varnishing of waterproof cloth, use of manganese dioxide in glass making, prevention of rusting, identification of paints and of greases. Based on their properties, he described three distinct types of substances. First, those which vaporize when heating, like camphor, arsenic, and ammonium chloride. Secondly, metals, for example, gold, silver, lead, copper, iron. and thirdly, the category of compounds which can be converted into powder. He thus paved the way for such later classification as metals, non-metals, and volatile substances. He devoted his effort to the development of basic chemical methods and the study of mechanisms of chemical reactions in themselves, and thus evolved chemistry as a science from the legends of alchemy. There's a big difference between chemistry and, of course, alchemy. Apart from his contribution in chemistry, he also contributed to other sciences, such as medicine and astronomy. His books on chemistry include his Kitab al-Kimiyya and Kitab al-Sab'in, which were translated into Latin and later into various European languages. Several technical terms devised by Jabir, such as alkali, are still found in various European languages and have become even part of scientific vocabulary. His various breakthroughs, for example, preparation of acids for the first time, notably nitric, hydrochloric, citric, and tartaric acids, and emphasis on systematic experimentation are outstanding, and it is on the basis of such works that he can justly be regarded as the father of modern chemistry. In the words of Max Meyerhoff, the development of chemistry in Europe can be traced directly to Jabir ibn Hayyan. Any comments on Jabir?
Well, obviously he was a very monumental figure because of his particular work in chemistry and establishing a new foundation, a solid foundation for chemical studies, which, as you mentioned, distinguished between kind of mythological ideas about the transformation of substances from one form to another, which is mainly kind of alchemy, and that's often tied to certain kinds of legendary material or ideas, imbuing objects with kind of sacred powers or other powers. And this is actually very much a scientific enterprise. It's not associated with those kinds of legendary issues. Jabir was a serious scholar, very much interested in experimentation and obtaining accurate, reproducible results. And I think this is simply a hallmark of this Muslim awareness of the necessity to have a scientific method. Oftentimes we associate the scientific method with something that arose more recently with the scientific revolution in Europe and so forth. And of course, the scientific method has been improved and elaborated in recent times or in the last few centuries, but there was an earlier foundation for that very keen objective approach to information, and Jabir represents that. And obviously his inventions, the alembic, which you mentioned, is a very significant invention, and any high school student with a Bunsen burner and a flask will immediately be able to identify with Jabir's attempts to create a device to distill liquids and distill elements so that the essences of various matters could be extracted. And, you know, there are very practical considerations. If you want to create a particular medicine to heal somebody out of certain herbs or plants, then you can place them in some sort of alcohol or water solution and distill that, and then you have the extract, which you can then administer in various ways. And so these are very practical as well as kind of objective studies, and I think that's the value of Jabir ibn Hayyan.
I think you mentioned the idea of alchemy and chemistry very significant, because I think one was bordering more on some kind of magic potions and the idea, and you know, from that kind of approach that some people had, and people expected, you know, maybe the holy man or the religious man or the man who was able, the medicine man somehow, mm-hmm. to have some kind of magical, there was the relationship between the idea of magic, the holiness of the person, mm-hmm. to the medicine. Whereas this, as you mentioned now, was completely a scientific enterprise.
Absolutely.
And he was the one who thank you for that, Munir. The next figure we look at is Muhammad bin Musa al-Khawarizmi, al-Gharzm. And by the way, al-Gharzm itself is a word that is used, and we'll deal with that. His name was Abu Abdullah Muhammad ibn Musa al-Khawarizmi. He was born in what is today present-day Uzbekistan. And he migrated to a place south of Baghdad as a child. Of course, he lived around the early part of 800. He was early 9th century. And is best known for introducing the mathematical concept algorithm, which is also named after his last name. The idea of algorithm is from, you know, from Al-Khwarizmi. Al-Khwarizmi was one of the greatest mathematicians that ever lived. He was the founder of several branches and basic concept of mathematics. Al-Khwarizmi influenced mathematical thought to a greater extent than any other medieval writer. He is recognized as the founder of algebra. As he not only initiated the subject in a systematic form, but also developed it to the extent of giving analytical solutions of linear and quadratic equations. The name algebra, the subject algebra, is derived from his famous book, Al-Jabr wal-Muqabila. So you can imagine, the science of algebra is named after his book. Algorithm is named after the perfect algorithm. And what is very disappointing, for example, is the fact that in my learning in school, all the years at school, and believe it, it was many years, and at high school and university, no mention was, I'd never heard this man's name ever being used. Mm-hmm. And this is also part of what Breitfeld refers to, our denying of our history.
Sure.
Al-Khwarizmi also developed the calculus of two errors, which led him to the concept of differentiation. The influence of Al-Khwarizmi on the growth of mathematics, astronomy, and geography is well established in history. His approach was systematic and logic. And not only did he bring together the then prevailing knowledge on various branches of science, but also enriched it through his original contribution. He adopted the use of zero, a numeral of fundamental importance, leading up to the so-called arithmetic position and the decimal system. His pioneering work on the system of numerals, known as algorithm or algorism, of course, is named after him. In addition to introducing the Arabic numerals, he developed several mathematical and arithmetic procedures, including operations on fractions. He revised Ptolemy's views on geography, and 70 geographers worked under his leadership and produced the first map of the globe known in 830. So, two subjects named after him. He was not only a mathematician, he was also a geographer and a person who translated the works of ancient scholars. So, any thoughts on Khwarizmi?
Well, I think, obviously, again, he is also one of the well-known, among those who study this issue, he is very well-known. And more in general Western works of world history and science, figures such as Al-Khwarizmi and others are beginning to be recognized. In fact, Ibn Sina, which I believe you'll be talking about, there's a mural of him or a painting of him in the University of Paris as in their medical school. And likewise, Ibn Rushd, who is, again, somebody that we'll be talking about, there's a statue of him in Cordoba, and he's considered one of the native sons of the city. So this is a modern recognition of these Muslim scholars. So those kinds of things are developing and need to happen to a greater degree, just so that we can have a more accurate representation of the major figures of our collective civilization and history. But the interesting thing about Al-Khwarizmi was he was one of the leading figures in the Bayt al-Hikmah, which was founded in Baghdad. Founded by Al-Ma'mun, the Khalifa or the Caliph at the time, who was the son of Harun al-Rashid, and Jabir ibn Hayyan, who we just spoke about, worked under Harun al-Rashid's rule, and Al-Ma'mun continued that tradition of a ruler or a state patronizing learning. And this is also very significant because it wasn't simply independent activity. Although the individual scholars were very interested in the pursuit of knowledge, it was such the circumstances were such that the state itself was interested in promoting that scholarship and translating many of these works from Greek and Persian and Sanskrit into Arabic. And so that phenomenon, I think, is very important to recognize. And those scholars who produced new works were often rewarded based on the weight of the books that they produce. So the more scholarship that they produce, the more compensation they received. And so this was obviously an extra incentive, but it showed the value of scholarship to the ruler, that he would be ready to disperse with gold dinars based on the amount of scholarship that was produced. And the last thing I want to say about this, which is also relevant to some of the other scholars that you may talk about, is that not only did the Arabs and Muslims translate these Greek and Persian and other works and study them and pass them along and build on them, they actually corrected some of them. Ptolemy's ideas were obviously important at the time that he was writing and subsequent to that, but some of these Muslim scholars in centuries later, after Ptolemy, realized that he had made certain errors, particularly in the astronomy and the geographical texts. Muslim scholars subsequently went in and revised some of those views, whether that involved calculating the circumference of the Earth or calculating the position of certain stars or the distance between two places. All of these things were further refined as these Muslim scholars in their heyday, in their prime, were addressing these same issues. So I think it's important to recognize that Aristotle, Ptolemy, or any other of these earlier scholars, you know, were part of a progression of scholarship. And today's scholars obviously would look back at some of the medieval scholarship and correct that information. So there's a constant process of evaluating, and that's a human concern. And I think we have to recognize that these particular scholars were part of that process of revising information that was found to be incorrect.
To our listeners, please feel free to contact us. You have our numbers that will appear on the screen, and you have the information. You contact us by email or the number you can call us is 1-800-339-1193 for any contribution or questions that you may have. 1-800-339-1193. You're welcome to call us and to air some of your views or any comments that you may have, or add some points that you wish to contribute to towards the program. About Al-Khawarizmi, for example, one of the points that I mentioned, I think, early on, is the problem that I have despite a growing recognition, as you mentioned, of our common cultural heritage, and of course, we discussed it last week, the fact that civilizations virtually, you know, they impact on one another all the time, and each civilization is built on the previous, and of course, Islam was somewhat the first global civilization. In other words, it went beyond ethnic or culture or beyond particular locality and geography. It was all embracing, and many people contributed towards it from various nations and in various parts of the world. But there's still somewhat an absence. There's an acknowledgement in some academic circles, but somehow you don't find it still in the textbooks of the schools. Mm-hmm. It's not that, you know, there's an acknowledgement of many things that were ignored in the past. But these things are acknowledged in some academic circles, mm-hmm. of course, in almost all academic circles. But somehow or the other, it doesn't filter down to the high school. I'm rest assured, believe me, if I go to 99.9% of students in 99% of the schools, mm-hmm. and ask them any one of these names, mm-hmm. not only won't be familiar with them, they would never have heard of them mm-hmm. at all.
Well, I think that may have been true in the past, but the current generation of textbooks, at least in the United States, yeah. that are being produced by some of the primary textbook publishers, do reference and actually develop significant chapters on Islamic history generally, and some of these key figures like Al-Khawarizmi. There definitely would be information about these figures there. Now, those textbooks are essentially derived from academic work, so there, you know, I think that information will be found in those textbooks more and more. The challenge still lies in the public sphere. In popular knowledge, popular history, there is a tremendous lack of information. And there, because people receive information from many different sources, whether it's the media or whether it's textbooks and other sources, there isn't a clear representation of a kind of a global cumulative scientific history. It's still very much kind of Euro-oriented and very much based on this idea that the modern world is associated with European and Western culture.
Okay. Are there any efforts being made by any Muslim institutions or so to address that issue of its schools and so on, that any progress that have been made, especially regarding the history at least? I mean, this is very important.
Sure. I mean, in the United States, there is, you know, a national organization called the Council on Islamic Education, which I have been involved with, that has over the past decade or so been very much involved in bringing to the attention of publishers and others in the education field contemporary academic scholarship, which simply informs those publishers of this information, which again in the university level is well known but has not necessarily been translated for other levels of education. And so those publishers are now doing that in part because of the efforts of organizations like that organization.
Okay, that's very good. So efforts have been made and they're well received, I suppose.
Sure.
Okay. The next person we are looking at is Hussein ibn Abdullah ibn Sina. He's known in the West as Avicenna. He was one of the most famous physicians, philosophers, encyclopedists, mathematicians, and astronomers of his time. His major contribution to the medical science was his famous book, Al-Qanun Fit-Tib, known as the Canons of Medicine in the West. No deliberation on the science of medicine can be complete without reference to Ibn Sina or Avicenna. He was born in an area in Bukhara, which is in Central Asia, and later moved to Rai, which is in Persia, and to Hamdan, which is also in Persia, where he wrote his famous Al-Qanun Fit-Tib. He finally moved to Isfahan, and where he completed his monumental work. Now, Ibn Sina lived around 980, around about 981. To 1037, he passed away in the year 1037 after Christ, AD. And his major contribution to medical science, which you have mentioned, is the Qanun, Fit-Tib, or the Canons of Medicine. It is an immense encyclopedia of medicine extending over a million words. In the Canons, he reviewed the medical knowledge available from ancient and Muslim sources. It's an entire review. Due to its systematic approach, formal perfection, as well as its intrinsic value, the canons of Ibn Sina superseded that of his predecessors Ar-Razi and Hawi and even the works of Galen, and it remained supreme for six centuries. The canons didn't deal with general medicines, drugs. In fact, it deals with 760 drugs, various diseases affecting all parts of the body from head to foot, and also with pharmacopoeia. It was recognized as the most authentic materia medica. Among his original contributions are such advances as recognition of the contagious nature of tuberculosis and distribution of disease by water and soil and interaction between psychology and health. He was the first to describe meningitis, and he was the first physician who suggested the treatment of lacrimal fistula and introduced a medical probe for the channel. Ibn Sina was the first scientist to describe the minute and graphic description of different parts of the eye, such as conjunctive sclera, cornea, choroid, iris, retina, layer lens, aqueous humor, optic nerve, and optic chiasma. He observed the aorta. The aorta was, of course, an Arabic word, aorta, which means the large valve leading from the heart. He observed that the aorta, at its origin, contains three valves and so on. He went to deal with that in detail and also studied and wrote quite a bit about the spleen and the kidney. The canon, or the Qanun Fit-Tib, the canons of medicine, was translated into Latin by Gerard of Cremona in the 12th century. It became the textbook for medical education in the schools of Europe. The demand for it may be appreciated from the fact that in the last 30 years of the 15th century, it was republished 16 times, 15 editions being in Latin and one in Hebrew, and that it was reissued more than 20 times during the 16th century. In 1930, Cameron Gruner partly translated this book into English, entitled A Treatise on the Canons of Medicine of Avicenna. From the 12th to the 17th centuries, the canons served as a chief guide to medical science in the West. Dr. William Osler, author of The Evolution of Modern Science, wrote, and I quote, "The Canons of Medicine has remained a medical Bible for a longer period than any other work, unquote. Ibn Sina's other book, Kitab al-Shifa, or Book of Healing, was a philosophical encyclopedia covering a vast area of knowledge from philosophy to science. His philosophy synthesizes Aristotelian tradition, Neoplatonic influences, and Muslim theology. Kitab al-Shifa was known as Sanatio in his Latin translation. He also made several astronomical observations and devised a similar device to the vernier to increase the precision of instrumental readings. A monumental personality.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, as you indicated, he was very significant as a medical figure, and of course he also wrote on music, he wrote on physics, which was very interesting. One of the ideas that he postulated in his thoughts about physics was that both speed of he postulated that the speed of light has to be finite. It's not something that's infinite. And for someone at that point in time who doesn't have knowledge about photons and other particles of light specifically, and he's only experiencing light in its kind of general, you know, radiating sense, he's able to postulate that it actually has a very specific speed. And obviously this is a precursor to Einstein's theories of relativity, which obviously deal with space and time and the speed of light and all of those issues. As far as medicine is concerned, 5 centuries, his book was used in the West and in the East. It was the standard book on how to perform surgery, how to diagnose illnesses, how to prepare medicines, and so it's quite a significant achievement and quite a significant contribution to world civilization. Obviously, when healthcare is improved in any society, that opens the door for other developments to take place.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the fact you mentioned his book was a textbook for 5 to 6 centuries, at least 500 years. I mean, despite the fact that they were later scientists, it must have been something of very high caliber. You know, I'm sure there were commentaries written on it. I'm sure there were works that were, you know, there were further advances in medicine. But still to hold that position as a medical Bible, virtually, it is really remarkable. I think it's unsurpassed in history.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, one of the key themes of this particular issue of the Muslims' role in the development of science is that these scientists provided a strong, solid foundation for all subsequent work. Without this foundation, many of the things that have led to the modern period would not have happened in that time period, may develop at some point in time. But in medicine, in astronomy, in all of these fields, a strong foundation was laid. And obviously this medical textbook or book was something upon which other scholars could confidently build.
Yeah. Please feel free to call us at 1-800-339-1193, 1-800-339-1193. We have a question here on the internet. I ask the question. I see our listeners are a bit lazy today. I pose the question and they pose it back to me. Being as lazy as my listeners, I'll pass it on to my guests. The question being asked is, were there any non-Muslims who became prominent? And if any, of course we mentioned that there were, but could maybe some names be given? Were there any that we could recall? Were there non-Muslims who became prominent? I'm a bit disappointed by listeners today that they are giving the question back to me. I thought I'll pose some questions to them. They'll do some research and come back to me. Mm-hmm. Please feel free to call us. The numbers you have it there with you, so please do call us, whether by internet or by phone, 1-800-339-1193. So please feel free to call us for any comments or contribution. And thank you to the question here. Were there non-Muslims who became prominent, and who were they?
Certainly there were a number of non-Muslims, often Christian or Jewish, who played very significant roles in the scientific circles of learning, as well as in the political realm in terms of being administrators and historians and writers. Among the scientists we know of, Hunayn ibn Ishaq, yeah, who worked at the Dar al-Hikmah or the Bayt al-Hikmah.
By the way, for the listeners, his name was the name was mentioned among the other names.
That's right.
So I said at least one that I recognize, Hunayn ibn Ishaq, and he was also referred to in the snippet we saw from Baghdad. And Mr. Munir is referring to that personality, Ibn Ishaq. Were there any others?
There are several others. And even though we're only maybe naming three or four individuals in this particular instance, we can surmise that there were countless others. And it's a matter of simply going into various histories and looking up that information. But certainly non-Muslims, I mean, it was a society in which Muslims and the minority communities, which were primarily Jewish and Christians, were involved on a day-to-day basis, and they collectively developed a society which was designed to meet the needs of all of the people in the society. And there are very many dimensions to that, but suffice to say that all of these people felt integrated into a common society, and so it would be natural for them to be participating. If they had certain talents, and they would be sought out and requested to participate and compensated accordingly. Another important figure was Jurji bin Bakhtishu, who was a member of a famous household in Baghdad, and they helped with the administration. But he himself was a court physician to al-Mansur, one of the famous Abbasid caliphs. In Spain, we have a situation where the manuscript, a botanical manuscript, was sent by the ruler of Constantinople to the caliph in Cordoba, Abdul Rahman II, and none of the caliph's personal scholars, or the Muslim scholars, were not able to translate the Greek into Arabic, and it turned out that one of the Jewish scholars at court, Hazde ibn Shaprut, was given the task of translating that botanical text into Arabic, and he was right there among all the rest of the courtiers. And likewise, there were other Jewish viziers and administrators in various kingdoms in Spain. And in terms of philosophy and some of these other scientific fields, including medicine, Moses Maimonides is a famous figure, and he was a contemporary of Ibn Rushd, whom we'll be talking about. So all of these figures and many, many more figures were involved.
Yeah, I think, thank you very much for the question, by the way. Actually, it's my question, but thank you nonetheless for posing it back to me. But I think that this is very important to understand that. And I think also the golden age of the Jewish learning was said to be at the time of Muslim rule in Spain. I think the earlier comment made by the by Professor Hiti, when I mentioned Professor Hiti's mentioning about the fact that when you say the Arab scholars, or it was those whose tongue was Arabic, or those who wrote in the Arabic language and such. Like, you know, like we say, for example, the Western world today, it doesn't mean necessarily West or East in a sense, but referring to that which is linked to Europe or linked to... So this is the idea, I think. So people need to understand that. And I thank the questioner for posing that question back to us. And thank you for answering that one. So the next scholar we're looking at is Umar al-Khayyam. Umar al-Khayyam. Now, Umar al-Khayyam is very well known as a poet. His Ruba'iyat are very popular. If you go into any of the bookstores, you find Umar al-Khayyam very popular. And is known even in the Muslim world as a poet. But actually, his major contribution was not necessarily poetry. He was an outstanding mathematician and an astronomer. He was also a philosopher and a physician. And in the history of Western philosophy, Bertrand Russell remarks that Umar Khayyam was the only man known to him who was both a poet and a mathematician. I think we may have a picture of Umar Khayyam. Umar Khayyam was reformed the solar calendar in 1079 of the Christian era. In the West, he is best known, as I mentioned, for his poetic works, the Ruba'iyat, or the Quatrains, which were translated by Edward Fitzgerald in 1859. His full name was Ghiyath-ud-Din Abdul Abul Fateh Umar ibn Ibrahim al-Khayyam. He was born in Nishapur in the province of Khorasan, in the, what is now the Persia, larger Persia at the time, in the area of Persia, Afghanistan. And he was educated there, and he went to various centers of learning in Bukhara, in Central Asia, Southern Russia, and Samarkand also in Central Asia, and Isfahan, which is in modern-day Iran. And he eventually died in Nishapur, where he was born. So he lived around the 11th century. And he made a major contribution to mathematics, particularly in algebra. And his books, Maqalat fil Jabr wal Muqabila, on algebra, provided great advancement in this field. And he classified many algebraic equations based on their complexity and recognized 13 different forms of cubic equations. He was also the first to develop binomial theorem and determine binomial coefficients. He extended Euclid's work on giving new definition of ratios and included the multiplication of ratios. He also contributed to the theory of parallel lines. His calendar, At-Tariq al-Jalali, is what was somewhat an improvement on the Gregorian calendar. And he measured the length of the year as 365.242189858156 days. In other words, he was almost the length of the year in our time is 365.242. And he was by 365.2. Our measurement at present is 365.242190. And his was 365.242198. So it was, you know, extremely close. And of course, he developed a method for accurate determination of specific gravity as well. So here we have Umar Khayyam. To be very frank with you, before doing much research in teaching the course here at Cal State Domingo Hills, when I did Umar Khayyam, mm-hmm. I was looking for to give a great Islamic poet, mm-hmm. and I looked at the poetry, mm-hmm. and then to my amazement, I knew he was a mathematician as well, but really he was maybe more a mathematician than he was a poet, but he's more known for his poetry.
Sure, and that's true in kind of Western circles as well. He's known because of the Rubaiyat,
yes,
more than anything else, yet he is one of the figures who took Al-Khawarizmi's mathematical ideas to the next level of sophistication,
yes.
And his writings are a testament to that. He was a very keen intellect, obviously, and very important.
Yes. His Maqalat, you mentioned now, he took the writings of Khawarizmi to another level. And Maqalat al-Jabr wal-Muqabila, the whole idea of Maqalat wal-Jabr wal-Muqabila, it's articles on that.
Mm-hmm.
So Maqalat is articles on the works of one of the questions that I wanted to ask, Umar Khayyam's poetry, you know, if you read it, for example, you'll find much reference to love and mm-hmm. peace and very much in love, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he may refer to mystical union, he may refer to the lover and the beloved in the sense of the creator and the creation and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But someone also seen as a romantic poet.
Sure. I mean, you know.
Though there's a spiritual level to what he's
yes.
saying, but even at a basic level.
Now, I think it's important to recognize that sometimes when we look at figures in history or even contemporary figures, we have a very dry approach to them, and we have to recognize the inherent humanity of all of these people. Umar Khayyam was perhaps someone who was a lover of life, yeah, as much as he was a lover of God, and so that comes out in his poetry and in his expression, and I think it's only reasonable for us to respect that about him and appreciate those aspects which point to our own humanity, whether those are good aspects or bad aspects, weaknesses or strengths. But he's a very human, real figure, and I think that's one of the reasons why his poetry and his writings appeal to many people even today.
Okay, I think we'll take a short break, we haven't completed. I think we have to do three more figures, and we'll just do that for the initial part if we can. Very interesting indeed. So we take a short break. It's been a long time. I mean, normally we take a break after an hour. It's been an hour and a half, but we'll take a break and we'll be back for about another 20 minutes or so with Brother Munir Sheikh from UCLA, and thereafter we'll go on to the other section, which will be the last hour of our program, perhaps. So please don't go away. We'll be here waiting for your calls and for your emails. And please give me all questions, not mine. I'll be here. Hope you'll be there. And come back soon. Welcome back to Cal State University, Domingo Hills. This is the SBS 318 course. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan. And I have with me Munir Sheikh from the UCLA. And, of course, we are dealing with Islam's contribution to global civilization, part 2. And we're rounding off the last part. We just dealt with Umar Khayyam, And we mentioned that he was both an astronomer, a well-known poet and philosopher and physician. And Umar Khayyam, referred to by Bertrand Russell in his History of Western Philosophy, he said he was the only man known to him both as a poet and a mathematician. So that's a reference to one of the great scholars, Umar Khayyam, and which we dealt with. We also dealt with the previous scholars that we dealt with was Nafisa bint Hassan, Jabir ibn Hayyan. There we have a picture of Umar Khayyam, drawing of his. Muhammad al-Khawarizmi, Hussein ibn Sina, and of course, Umar al-Khayyam, the picture which you see in the background there. The next person we are dealing with is Abdul Walid Muhammad ibn Rushd, or known as Averroes in the West. Ibn Rushd was a genius of encyclopedic scope and spent a great part of his fruitful life as a judge and a physician. He was known in the West for being the grand commentator on the philosophy of Aristotle, and whose influence penetrated the minds of even the most conservative of Christian ecclesiastes in the Middle Age, including men like St. Thomas Aquinas. Ibn Rushd, as I mentioned, known as Averroes in the West, was born in Cordova in Spain. He was a Spanish Muslim, and he lived around the early part of the 12th century. And he was well versed in matters of faith and law, which qualified him for the post of qadi or judge. And he was also keenly interested in philosophy and logic, and tried to reconcile philosophy and religion in many of his works. In medicine, he was also a scholar of medicine. He made a remarkable contribution, of course, to philosophy, to logic, to medicine, to music, jurisprudence. And his writing spread more than 20,000 pages, the most famous of which deal with philosophy, medicine, and jurisprudence. In medicine alone, he wrote over 20 books on medicine. So though a philosopher and a translator, yet 20 books on medicine alone. He's very well known for his book Kitab al-Kulliya fi Tib, written in 1162. His Latin translation was known as the Colliget, and in which Ibn Rushd expounded on various aspects of medicine, including the diagnosis, cures, and prevention of disease. According to John William Draper, in the History of the Intellectual Development of Europe, Ibn Rushd is credited with the discovery of sunspots. Ibn Rushd's translations of his works were into various languages, including Latin, English, German, and Hebrew. And most of his commentaries on philosophy are preserved in the Hebrew translations or in the Latin translations from the Hebrew, and very few original in Arabic. So here we have a scholar, and very unique, a Spanish European Muslim scholar, Ibn Rushd, and whose works have been preserved from the Arabic into the Hebrew, into Latin, mm-hmm. but the Hebrew ones are the ones, so it's remarkable.
Yes, and his major value to us today is that he is the primary translator of Aristotle and the commentator on Aristotle. Many of Aristotle's works would not be known except for the fact that Ibn Rushd decided to study those works when they were available to him, and some of those earlier works are no longer available to us directly, but they're available to us in the works of Ibn Rushd. So what he has commented gives us a window into Aristotle's thinking, and that's significant generally as a matter of intellectual history. And his other major contribution, of course, is the confirmation that the effort to think about the world and to employ reason to arrive at conclusions is consistent with the religious worldview. And he being a Muslim, and in the case of Maimonides, his contemporary, being Jewish, both of them respectively could look at their own sacred texts, whether it be the Quran or the Torah and other writings, to investigate from their viewpoint what God is instructing them or educating them about the nature of the world, the nature of the cosmos. And the intellectual reflection in the field of philosophy also can be seen as arriving at the same ultimate conclusion, which is that there is a creator, there is a creation, there is a unity of existence, essentially. And these ideas are not simply things that, although we may take them for granted, those, you know, some people in the modern world may take those kinds of ideas for granted. These were very much debated in the medieval period, and it was scholars such as Ibn Rushd who made it possible to, in fact, reconcile philosophy and religion, and to essentially state that whether you arrive at the knowledge of God through a spiritual path or whether you arrive at the knowledge of God through a more intellectual path, these are essentially interrelated, and they reinforce each other.
The next person we're looking at is Jalaluddin Rumi. And of course, here now we're moving from these more the scientific, more to the spiritual and the metaphysical as well as the philosophical. Jalaluddin ibn Muhammad ibn Hussein al-Rumi was born in around 1207, 1208 in Balkh, which is now Afghanistan. And he was, of course, trained, one of his major teachers was Shamsuddin Tabrizi, one of the great scholars and before his time as well. And he was very famous for his mystical insights, his religious knowledge, and for his Persian poetry. And he used to teach a large number of pupils at his madrasa in Konya, where he eventually died. Konya is in Turkey. So though he was born in what is now Afghanistan, the greater Persia in those days, and then eventually moved to what is present-day Iran, he died and lays buried in Turkey. And his major contribution lies in Islamic philosophy and in spirituality. And this was largely embodied, tremendously embodied, in his poetry, especially through his famous work, The Mathnawi. He also wrote, besides The Mathnawi, a diwan, or collection of poems, and also Fihi Ma Fihi, a collection of mystical sayings. His impact on philosophy, literature, mysticism, and culture has been so deep throughout Central Asia and most Islamic countries that almost all religious scholars, mystics, philosophers, sociologists, and others have referred to his verses during all these centuries since his passing on. He is one of the few intellectuals and mystics whose view has so profoundly affected the worldview in its higher perspective in large parts of the world. That is Jalaluddin Rumi.
Well, Rumi's significance, not only as a writer, but it exists in terms of him being a central figure in what we call the Sufi tradition within Islam. He's one of the eminent founders of, there are a number of Sufi orders or brotherhoods or tariqas, and in fact these groups essentially are very gender egalitarian, so men and women, young and old, often are involved in Sufi tariqas. At least historically that has been the case, and he is known as one of the most important of these founders because of his very poetic nature of expression, which is found in his Mathnavi, and because of his unique ideas and his willingness to essentially do away with everything except for commitment to God, love of God, and all of this is reflected in his poetry. He's able to transcend the kinds of impositions and categories that human beings tend to place upon themselves in terms of an identity, and his way of breaking some of those limitations while remaining committed to the teachings of Islam and the teachings of the belief in the one God, monotheism, the sayings and the traditions of the Prophet, maintaining all of that, but at the same time not allowing a very parochial or limited understanding of what Islam is about, and using that as a basis to encourage other people to explore their own spirituality. I think that is the major contribution of Rumi, and that contribution extends until the modern period. Even today, in many countries, including here in the United States and in Europe, people are picking up Rumi's books simply out of interest for his spiritual insights, and those are universal.
I just took I went onto one of the sites to look at what books are available. Books published this year about Rumi, I mean, republished and so on. The Essential Rumi, The Soul of Rumi, a new collection of aesthetic poems, The Illuminated Rumi, Mathnawi of Jalaluddin Rumi, Hush, Don't Say a Thing to God, Passionate Poems about Rumi, A Journal of the Poetry of Rumi, The Love Poems of Rumi. These are just the books that are available right now. In fact, I think of all the poets you find, maybe a larger section in America you'd find maybe on Rumi. He's one of the most read scholars and writers, despite the fact that he lived so long ago.
Sure, and so, he has truly become a universal figure.
Oh, yes. The next scholar we're looking at is a geographer and explorer by the name of Abu Abdullah Muhammad ibn Battuta. Now, he is from West Africa and from Tangiers. And he went on a journey at the age of 21, which lasted for 30 years. You know, he was the only medieval traveler who is known to have visited the lands of every Muslim ruler of his time. And of course, it spanned very wide. He also traveled in Ceylon, which is present-day Sri Lanka, China, and Byzantium in South Russia. And the extent of his travels are estimated at approximately 75,000 miles in those days. In the course of his journey, he ventured through Algiers, Tunis, Egypt, Palestine, Syria, Mecca, Iraq, Iran, Mesopotamia, Yemen, Mombasa, East Africa, what is Bahrain. He crossed over the Black Sea, went to the Ukraine, went through Khorasan, central India, China, Goa, Maldives Islands, Malaya, Cambodia. And on his return to Fez, Ibn Battuta dictated the accounts of his travel to a person called Ibn Juzay al-Kalbi in about 1300 and around about 1330 when he came back. And of course, he's one of the most remarkable travelers of all time. He visited China 60 years after Marco Polo, and in fact, traveled much more than Marco Polo. Yet unfortunately, Ibn Battuta is rarely ever mentioned in geography books.
Yes, although that may have been true, I think more and more he is recognized as a significant world traveler in the medieval period. Obviously, Marco Polo kind of takes the, he's the poster boy for world travel, at least in that time period. But Ibn Battuta's achievements were significant and probably more significant as far as the amount of time he traveled and the distances that he traveled and different locales that he visited than Marco Polo. What's interesting is that Ibn Battuta had his journeys recorded after he came back, as you mentioned, and this represents a particular genre of literature called the Rihla literature. And so his book is called the Rihlat Ibn Battuta.
Yes.
And there are other Rihlas by other travelers which are also very, very interesting. There's a Rihlat Ibn Jubair, for example, who was a scholar from Valencia who went on a pilgrimage to Mecca and also visited various sites along the way in the Mediterranean and had his memoirs written down. These particular books provide us tremendous insight into the social relationships and different factors affecting the lives of people in the medieval time period. And so it's not simply a kind of idealized version of Muslim society, but by reading this genre of literature, you can actually get a real sense of what was happening on the ground and how people, what their commerce was like, what their educational systems were like in different parts of the world, and how they saw themselves as people of a particular region as part of a collective Muslim community, the Ummah at large. So it's very interesting to read these Rihla collections.
So it's very interesting to see, you know, Rumi is from Afghani, from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We had Ibn Rushd. We had now Ibn Rushd was a Spanish mm-hmm. European. Ibn Battuta is a West African, mm-hmm. and you know, so just the variety shows that you know that
sure.
You know of
and secondly, there were no boundaries between the. I mean, there obviously were political divisions. Different rulers ruled different territories, but Muslims and Jews and Christians who lived within the Muslim empire at large were fairly free to travel from region to region on business or on religious pilgrimage or other activities.
Okay. The last person we're going to deal with is someone contemporary, someone alive. I thought let's look at someone who's also, because people ask that was then, and of course the reason why we're dealing with these with those figures are that they were the ones who contributed to what the global civilization.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that they were not others, and they are not continuing to be other people. But the idea was that they were so instrumental and so influential in being a catalyst for what is today what we call modern civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the person we are looking at last is a contemporary American Muslim by the name of Ahmed Zuhail. He's the winner of the Physics and Chemistry Prizes. He was the Nobel Laureate in 1989. And Ahmed Zuhail is of the California Institute of Technology. In fact, in 1995, the Islamic Center of Southern California honored Zuhail for pioneering revolution in chemistry, whereby he used rapid-fire laser flashes that illuminate the motion of atoms in a molecule. And then 1995. In 1999, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said that Zoelle's work in the late 1980s, led to the birth of femtochemistry, the use of high-speed cameras to monitor chemical reactions in a scale of femtoseconds, or 0.00000000000001 of a second, 1/4,000,000,000th of a second. I've never seen so many zeros in my life. So a scientist describes Zoelle's studies of how chemical bonds break and new molecules form, as the ultimate level of observation. They said that because his work helps researchers manipulate chemical reactions on a fundamental level, it might lead to faster computer chips and ultra-precise machinery. And Professor Henry Kaptian, a laser expert at the University of Colorado in Boulder, said, "Everything in life is getting faster and faster. This work of Professor Zoelle lays the groundwork for technology that will develop over the next 20 to 50 years." Of course, Dr. Zoelle lives in San Marino, California. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences of in U.S., the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, American Philosophical Society, Third World Academy of Sciences, Italy, European Academy of Arts, Sciences and Humanities, France, and fellow of the American Physical Society and Sigma Xi Society. Of course, he was born in Egypt in 1946, and he lives in San Marino in California. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a picture of Ahmed Zoelle, maybe that can be shown to them. Any comments on that?
Well, one of the things that I often think about, especially in light of our terrible tragedy of September 11th, is that there's been a change in our public discourse. There's kind of been a reticence to look at the contributions of Muslim Americans or Arab Americans, or to question their involvement in American society. And I think that's an unfortunate regression in our collective development as Americans and as a society. One of the things that I said in another forum at UCLA immediately after the tragedy was that it's not really a question, and this is generally, whether it's Latinos or African Americans or Asians, and this has nothing to do with Muslims per se, but all of these different groups of people whom we often term as minorities often are described or are conceptualized in our public discourse as people who have come to this land and kind of ridden on the coattails of other other groups and who have kind of benefited and prospered because of America's greatness. And obviously it's a wonderful country that provides opportunities to different people. But what is significant to remember and realize is that America's strength today is a product of the contributions of many different people of many different backgrounds. It's not simply a question of new immigrants coming in and taking advantage of the system. It's actually a phenomenon whereby a constant cycle of immigration and people of different backgrounds growing in the United States together as part of various communities and contributing. And people like Ahmed Zoelle and those who are involved in the space program, those who are physicians, those who are in various fields, are directly responsible for the development of American science, American civilization, American prominence in various fields in the world. So I think it's important for us to recognize that this is an ongoing process, and without people like Dr. Zoelle, our country wouldn't be as blessed and prosperous as it would be. So it's not simply a matter of recognizing by ethnicity or religious group that such and such person made a contribution. It's to recognize that that contribution is integral to our very society's prosperity and prominence.
I don't think anyone could have said it better. Absolutely well captured in those words. By way of conclusion, I'd like to just deal with two things. One is the Arabic contribution to English and Spanish language. I was going to give a few words that are still being used today in English, an integral part of the English language, whether it be in science or medicine or whether just general words that are used. And just to see that some of these words are actually words from Arabic and also a few words from Spanish. There are about 5,000 to 6,000 words in Arabic and Spanish, in English and Spanish, that derive the roots from English. But I'm just giving a few here, for example. Arabic contribution to the English language, and a few words I'll give of Spanish as well. For example, alchemy, with alchemy from alchemia in Arabic. Alcohol from alcohol in Arabic. Algebra from al-jabr in Arabic. Algorithm from the name of the man al-Khawarizmi. Amber or ember that we talk about. The aorta in the heart from aorta. The atlas, which is the map that we talk about, atlas. Candy, which we eat from qandi in Arabic. Canon, which is law, is from the word qanun in Arabic for law. The carat by which we measure, it's qirat in Arabic, qirat, for the measurement of gems and so on. Checkmate in chess, actually it is from the word shah mat, which means the king is dead. Shah means the king, mat means he died. So the word checkmate in chess comes from the word Arabic, where shah mat, the king has died. Sifr for zero, from the word sifr, or cipher. Cotton, which we use, cotton, or cotton from Arabic. To drop something in someone's head, you know, drops or drop the team, you beat them, you drop them from what darab in Arabic, which means to beat. Elixir from elixir. Gazelle, which is a buck, also ghazal. Guitar from the word guitar. Limoon from the word lemon, from the lemon from the word limoon. Jasmine from the word yasmin. Magazine, the magazine, which we eat from the word magazine. Meningitis from meninges, from in Arabic meninges. Musk from the word musk in Arabic. Pancreas from the word bankras in Arabic. We go on a safari from the word safar in Arabic. Safari means a tour, and safari in Arabic means to journey. Safran, which we eat in the food, is from za'afran in Arabic. Sherbet from the word sharbah, or something which we drink. Sofa from the word sufa, which means a couch. In fact, in the Prophet's time, those that are ashabu sufa, the people who sit on the couch. People who sit, so the word sofa comes from that. Sugar from the word sukkar in Arabic. And syrup also from the word shurub or sharab. Then even in Spanish you have alhamra, alhamra from the word alhamra, which means red, referring to the red palace. So there's so alhamra, ahmar in Arabic is red. Almaida, almaida from almaida, which means the table. Alburj from alburj, which means the tower. Almiraya from the word almiraya, which means a mirror. And receive, which means the coast. And taifa, which also means a table. So from this we can see the tremendous amount of words that have emanated from that. By way of conclusion, I'd like to read an extract from the book we referred to last week quite a bit, World Civilizations. And on page 302, it's written, and I conclude with this. The Islamic or the Muslim accomplishment was stunning. Not only had the largely nomadic people from the Arabian backwater built one of the greatest empires of the pre-industrial world, but they had laid the basis for the first truly global civilization. Building on earlier religious traditions, especially Christianity and Judaism, Arab culture had nurtured Islam, one of the great universal religions of humankind. The mosques, the prayer rituals, and pilgrimages of the faithful, and the influence of Islamic law proclaimed the pervasive effects of this new creed on societies from Spain in the west to eastern Indonesia, from Central Asia to the savannas of West Africa. Religion and politics had been linked from the time of the Prophet Muhammad in the early 7th century, but under the caliphs and the early Abbasid caliphs who followed the Umayyads, religious legitimacy was used to build a powerful political order to govern vast domains of Islamic land. Again, the Muslim drew on the bureaucratic institutions, royal precedents, and even personnel of pre-existing civilizations, particularly those of Persia and the Byzantine Empire. In the arts and sciences, the Muslims initially relied heavily on the achievement of the classical civilizations of Greece and Mesopotamia. But the work of preserving and combining the discoveries of earlier people soon led to reformulation and innovation. As in religion and politics, Muslim people were soon making important contributions to learning, invention, and artistic creativity, which were carried by their armies and teachers to other civilizations in Europe, Africa, and Asia. Never before had a civilization spanned so many different cultures and combined such a patchwork of linguistic groups, religions, and ethnic types. Never before had a single civilization mediated so successfully between the other centers of civilized life. Never had a civilized lifestyle so deeply affected so many of the nomadic cultures that surrounded the pools of sedentary agriculture and urban life. Ironically, the context Islamic mediation made possible between the civilized core of the Eastern Hemisphere contributed much to the transformation in technology and organization that increasingly tilted the balance of power against the Muslim people eventually. But nonetheless, they laid the basis for the first truly global civilization. This from the book, World Civilizations. Brother Munir Sheikh, thank you very, very much for having you. It was a tremendous honor. We had you last week and the week before, and some time before also. We have really been enriched by your presence and for your contribution.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
Absolutely. It was great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. We take a break, and we'll be back with our next guest hereafter, Accessing Islam, Looking at Islam on the Internet. We'll be back within the next few moments. We'll be here. I hope you'll be there. Thank you very much. Welcome back to Cal State University, Domingo Hills. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan, for the SBS Social Behavioral Science 318 program on Islamic culture and civilization. We're coming live to you from Cal State University and, of course, on the local TV, cable TV, channel LA36, and globally on the Internet. So welcome for the last hour of this part two, Islam's contribution to global civilization. And, of course, we have dealt with that last week. And this week, thus far, we covered with our guest, our first guest we had was Munir Sheikh from UCLA. And we dealt with centers of learning as beacons of civilization, and particularly the role of mosque schools in Arabia, in Africa, in Europe, Central Asia, Middle East. And we discussed somewhat more in detail Timbuktu in West Africa and Baghdad in the Middle East. Thereafter, we dealt with 10 outstanding scholars amongst, of course, a galaxy of stars in the field of scholarship that contributed to the development of Islamic culture and civilization, and that contributed, you know, in a manner unsurpassed to global civilization. The scholars that we dealt with were Nafisa bint Hassan, Jabir ibn Hayyan, Muhammad al-Khawarizmi, Hussein ibn Sina, Umar al-Khayyam, Muhammad ibn Rushd, Jalaluddin Rumi, Ibn Battuta, and Ahmed Zuhail, the last one being the Nobel Prize winner for science in 1999, an American Muslim. And then we looked at some of the contribution of some of the terms, some Arabic words which are still in use, common terms used in the English and some in the Spanish language. Of course, there are hundreds of words. I only refer to about 20 or 25 of them. I think 5 in Spanish and about 20 or so in the English language. And then, of course, we concluded with an overview of the Muslim contribution or the measure of Muslim scientific achievement from the book World Civilization, which we referred to considerably in part one of our program, which was last week. But now we go on to something quite different in that, how do we access Islamic information? And of course, we are living now in a global village, and we are living in the e-world, we are living in the world of the Internet. And to give us some insight into that, we'll spend this hour accessing Islam, and specifically on the Internet. Let's take a look at a snippet from a program that we had before.
Islamic faith. Now, one of the places where such information is available is on the Internet. Channel 4's Ted Chen has details.
Welcome to a .com that's not starving for attention. At IslamicCity.com, hits have more than doubled since September 11, though many of the visitors that day sent messages like this. Expletive Allah, expletive Muhammad, and expletive every one of you. That anger and ignorance shook the company's employees, who are proud of their website and the bridges it builds.
We're creating this community in cyberspace, you know, where Muslims, you know, can come and interact with each other, you know, have various needs fulfilled.
we call upon people to be guided to the
needs like streaming video, the Quran in different languages, Islamic children's songs can all be found on the website, which also sells dozens of books on the history of Islam and its teachings. Chief Executive Officer Mohammed Abdul Alim says IslamicCity.com is used in more than 100 countries. But many of the more recent visits have come from non-Muslims, and something surprising happened after the initial spate of hate. Support.
We want you to know that you are Americans too.
Alim says 90% of the letters are now overwhelmingly positive. The man who wrote the profanity-laced email wrote back, "I asked your forgiveness in what I have done. My anger was completely misplaced."
It is really surprising, and it is, I think, a testament to our nation, where through this tragedy, we're able to do some serious soul-searching.
Those looking hard enough have found in Islam a community much like their own, filled with hard-working Americans trying to make a difference, and in the dot-com world trying to get noticed. Here, not a problem. Ted Chen, Channel 4 News.
And it really is a community, in addition to...
That was from NBC, if I'm correct, Channel 4 there, NBC, and of course the information about a particular website, Islamicity, and the person interviewed, one of the people interviewed there, is the CEO of Islamicity, and we have Muhammad Abdul Alim with us. Muhammad Abdul Alim, welcome, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, thank you very much for inviting me.
It's a pleasure having you here. We access so much information for this program from him that I wonder sometimes, should he be here or should I be here? But we thank you, Alim, for all the support that you have given to the universities thus far, and for all the information you make available to us.
You're welcome, thank you.
I found it very interesting that you mentioned that initially, of course, there was this negative reaction. I think based maybe on ignorance or people's reaction because of emotion and so on. And that people afterwards coming to the site maybe reading up a bit more about what the reality is and then, changing their mind. It's very interesting.
Absolutely. I think this medium is so powerful. It gives us the ability to, of course, first of all, provide people with objective information about Islam. Secondly, it gives us also an opportunity to interact with people who are coming to the site.
Yes.
And as they were showing, with all the hate mail that we were getting, all the interactions that we were getting, we communicate back to the people. And based on that, perceptions changed. I think the internet provides us with a very powerful medium to change perceptions, to gain a better understanding of whatever may be out there.
Mm-hmm.
You want to find any information about any topic, you can find that information on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
With more knowledge, with more awareness, we believe there is a much better chance for a peaceful coexistence in a rapidly shrinking global village that we are living in these days.
Mm-hmm.
We're extremely excited about this technology, and we want to make sure that we establish a place in cyber world where we can provide the true essence of Islam, the essence of peace, liberty, and justice that we hold on so dearly to needs to be expressed. And people need to know about this. That's why we are doing what we are doing, and we hope it's going to make a difference out there.
Well, I mean, this is partly what is happening here at the Calcutta University Domingo Hills, right, through this program, in trying, especially as a response to 9/11, in trying to bring greater awareness of what Islam is all about, and partly this is what you're doing. You are bringing Islam to the world. And maybe give us an idea as to the information and background as to what happens and
Well, I have some slides that I've prepared. I wanted to share some of these slides with your audience out here, which actually takes us through a scenario of what is the internet, how is the internet growing, and then show what we are doing also on the internet.
Yeah, I think it's generation Y, post generation Y. We're looking at now.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I would like to disperse your presentation with some questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anytime you have a question, just stop me, and we can go into those questions. If we can start the presentation, one of the things that we start off with is this is a futuristic technology. This is a technology that is very new. It is still rapidly developing right in front of us. So we're trying to predict how this technology is going to affect us. What are the different things that we'll be doing? For example, there was a very famous statement made: the only use I see for a radio is for a Sunday sermon. This is when the radio technology had just come about. In 1905, this was our president, Teddy Roosevelt, this is how he was seeing this new technology that was about.
I'm sure it's echoing sentiments of many people.
Absolutely.
I'm sure it wasn't something, maybe to them this was what it seemed.
Yes. The second statement that you see out there, I think there's a world market for maybe about 5 computers. This was Thomas Watson, the inventor of IBM.
He himself
did not see the global market or how this entire technology.
And that was when did he say that?
In 1943.
Okay, fine. Right.
So here we are gradually coming up with various ways of predicting which way is this technology leading us to. The next slide I have is taking you through various generations of technology. So we can see people born between 1930 and 50. These are respected elders. Then we have boomers and Generation X. I'm not even going to go into Generation Y. Who knows what they will be into. But when our elders were looking at slide rules, I'm part of the boomer generation. We were looking at calculators. In Generation X, of course, spreadsheets. The second line shows you rotary phones, touchtone phones, and now, of course, cell phones, party lines, conference calls, and chat rooms, outer space, inner space, and now we're looking at cyberspace, U.S. mail, also now called snail mail.
Believe me.
Very excited in our times when we came up with overnight mail and faxes. Mm-hmm. It was a new thing. Yeah. Now, of course, we cannot live without our email.
Yeah, so let me make it very clear to the listeners that you're referring to your time. Is it my time? Okay, I'm the later time.
Yes.
Yes, and the last one you had there was?
And the last one I had was the Spirit of St. Louis, the first flight across Atlantic. Boomers grew up with the Concorde going across the Atlantic. And, of course, now we're looking at spaceship Columbia, reaching out into the stars. This is showing you how technology is rapidly developing, right in front of us. The next slide that I have shows how various technologies have penetrated the U.S. market.
Yeah, this is one of the questions would like to have information about is, some of the media, like the printing press, took a long time before it really was effective.
Right.
And then, of course, the radio, I think, maybe more so, and the television more so. I suppose the slide may show that.
Yes.
The time limit, how things grow and how internet or the TV has grown in relation to, how long it took the printing press to really have a tremendous effect.
So you're exactly right. I think the printing press was one of the first mass media technologies to have come about. Other newer technologies that came about penetrated the market much much faster. Okay. As the next slide shows,
the use of various technologies in
if you look at telephone, in 120 years, the telephone now has about 95% market penetration in the U.S. That means that 95% of the population here have access to the telephone. We can also see how electricity gradually became available to the population here. Mm-hmm. And then the other media technologies, television and radio, you can see the growth curve. in a very short amount
radio
of time.
Radio and TV is very similar, it seems.
It's very similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
We can see that the time is being compressed.
Right.
Yeah. There's just a matter of maybe a decade or so. But then with the World Wide Web, when it came about on the scene in 1994, that is a hockey stick curve, you know, expanding very rapidly. Mm-hmm. According to some estimates, 60% of the U.S. population now has access to the Internet. About 60%. Of the U.S. population has access to the Internet. So we can see how rapidly this this technology is growing.
And how far-reaching it is.
And how far-reaching it is. I have some other slides that talk about, the global population online, basically, and how it is being forecasted. In 2005, according to some estimates, there will be about over 700 million Internet users online. In this slide, you can see about 207 million internet users in the U.S. and about 558 million internet users outside the U.S. And I've also made a small pie showing what is the Muslim population projection also for the U.S. and for the global internet market also. These are, of course, projections. Things are growing very rapidly, and we may see a much more rapid change than what you see over here.
So, the one question I have on that one, there, just briefly, look at the pie chart that you have there. You said 200 and how many million people in America have access to the internet?
In 2005, is being projected that 207 million internet users will be online. In the U.S.
So how many are they now, more or less?
Right now, if it's about 60% of the population, it is close to about, 80 million or something like that, I think, in the U.S. With about 207 million, that's close to full market penetration.
So you're looking at possibly maybe 95% or 90%?
Probably about close to 90%, 95% market penetration at that time.
Unbelievable.
That's how fast this this technology is growing. So what are we doing in this space? This is a space that is rapidly developing right in front of us. Yeah. And how are we utilizing this space? We started this the project Islamicity in 1995 as a way to promote and disseminate Islamic information. Yeah, from an objective perspective, from a holistic perspective, not just a theological perspective, but we wanted to present Islam from a community aspect. That's why when you come to our Islamicity, you will see a various things happening, various types of services that are available, whether it is a travel service. We organize trips, for example, different places. Munir was on your show just a while back. He organizes a trip for us to show the Islamic history in Spain, for example. We're organizing another trip coming up this summer. That is the one type of activity that is going on. We have a online bazaar where people can buy products, whether they are books, toys for children,
on Islam,
and other educational material or gifts, for example, that someone might be looking for. So that is basically the environment that we are creating, and of course we are working with Cal State Dominguez Hills. The program that we're on right now, all of them are being archived on Islamicity, and later on, if you get a chance to show the site, I'll show you where we are doing e-learning and how we're archiving all of these programs.
Okay, so the question here then I would like to ask is that. Though you are based in the U.S., you are providing a wide variety of information. It's basically information about Islam and, of course, education in general, but Islam in particular.
Right.
How widespread is your audience? I mean, are the people who come from which parts of the world? Is it predominantly from Muslim countries, or is it predominantly Muslim people?
Right.
This is the kind of information. I mean, how is it accessed?
The nature of the internet is global.
Mm-hmm.
There are no geographic boundaries.
Of course. But I mean, who from your information that you have, that you are able to access? Many countries do you have people from?
Absolutely. I have a slide showing you where the various visitors are coming from. This is based on two aspects. The first is the internet infrastructure in these countries, and of course, the Muslim population in these various areas. We can see that the number one visits that we get on our site is from the United States. That is because this is where the oldest infrastructure is. This is where there's a significant amount of Muslim population also who is accessing this the site. You can see.
Let's go to the top 20.
The top 20. You can see UK, Canada, Malaysia, Australia, Singapore, Saudi Arabia, Netherlands, France, Germany, UAE, Turkey, Indonesia.
UAE is the Arab Emirates now, correct?
United Arab Emirates, South Africa, Sweden, Pakistan, Great Britain and UK, basically they're the same, but we split it out based on where the IPs are coming from, Belgium, Japan and India. And it is very interesting because we monitor this list very regularly, and we are able to see how internet infrastructures are developing in various parts of the world. And based on the rapid development of internet infrastructures, this list might change. Of course, we can see that the largest amount of audience that we get is from the United States, because this is where the largest number of internet users are also.
Okay. That
holds true across the board also. Yeah.
So you find this 20, top 20 more or less, remains more or less stable. I mean, the visitors, I mean, the top 20 will remain. You may have changes here and there in number 17 and 15 and so on.
Right.
But generally, are they quite stable? I mean,
no, they're not stable. As internet infrastructures are developing in various Muslim countries, for example, those countries will start creeping up on this top 20 list. Some of the countries that were like number 40 or so now are in the top 20 list because they've invested that much in the internet infrastructure.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yes, it gives us a very good feeling of how the technology is being developed in various countries and how people are using the internet also. The pursuit for knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people are going online and trying to find out information about various things.
I mean, and how are the numbers? Are numbers constant, or do you find do you have a growth in amount of people visiting the site and so on? I mean, is it a...
No, we were at about 278,000 users in September 2000, and as the graph shows, by November 2001, we were at 2 million visitors, and that is a growth of about over 700% in a very short amount of time.
You have the unique. What is unique visitor? What do you mean by unique visitors?
Unique visitor would be any time one visitor comes to our site in 1 month. That is considered a unique visitor. Now, that unique visitor may come several times to the site, but it is still considered as one unique visitor.
Oh, so it's not, if a person comes 10 times, it's one visit.
That's right.
Oh, so, and then you have a number of 2 million, it is November
12. 2 million in November, there were 2 million. Of course, November was also Ramadan, so more people are online. It's a little bit cyclical, but still, you know, there's a significant growth.
278,000 to 2 million,
it's
phenomenal. Increases. Unbelievable.
Yes.
Unbelievable. That's what happened to. And regarding, I mean, I don't want to break it up, but I mean, what is the ratio of the Muslim internet users? You know,
currently we estimate that there are about 2 million Muslim internet users in the U.S. For example. Out of this, 1.3 million have visited Islamicity at one time or the other.
Right.
Since we in the last year, actually, that is where our statistics are coming from.
Yeah.
So that is also a very interesting statistic that we are we are tracking.
Yeah. So what would be the non-Muslim?
Before 9/11, we had about close to
percentage-wise,
there were about 10% of our visitors were non-Muslim. Of course, people coming to the site, we don't ask them what faith they belong to, but we have done informal surveys on the site.
So how much has grown to now after September 11th?
After September 11th, it has grown quite dramatically. Mm-hmm. At about 10% now, we are 400,000, we estimate, visits a month are from non-Muslims that are coming to the site.
Okay.
And that is a significant increase from before. It used to be like around 40,000 or 50,000, I believe.
Okay. Now, so after September 11th, there's a tremendous increase. What about people, sending messages through your site? And what about the inquiries about Islam or about intimate on the news? Or you find that also increasing, and you find that they're quite busy in that regard?
That has also increased very dramatically. Before 9/11, we used to get about 6,500 messages, comments, inquiries, everything that used to come to our site. Now we get about 15,000 messages every month. These range from all kinds of inquiries about Islam, or Muslims also inquiring about various things. So again, that has increased dramatically also.
So after September 11th, there was a significant increase in traffic.
Well, according to a Pew Foundation study, they have found out that more people are now interested in religion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. People are praying more. People are more inquisitive about religion as a whole. We can see that very clearly on our site, where there is a heightened awareness about the need to get more information about Islam.
Now, are you able to access it, because you also have news?
Yes.
And you also have information on Islam, you have videos and so on and so forth that maybe you'll have show us some later on. But what I'd like to know is that how many people that you know have come to the to your site for information, for knowledge on something? Not necessarily for news. Do you have any breakdown on that? Is Islamicity also used the source of reference for news, or purely just for Islam and Islamic world?
No, it is being very heavily used. If you go to our site, we have a significant section reserved for updated news, where we get news from all over the world, from various media organizations, and present that news to our audience also. It gives people a one-stop shop to look at news related to the Muslim world, related to Muslim interests, from all over the world, in one place. So that is a very popular section in Islamic City.
In the previous slide, you showed growth in messages and inquiries.
Yes.
And you showed that among the Muslims, I think it is, before September 11th, there were 6,500, and after that, by November 11th. You had about 15,000,
so
230% increase.
Yes.
What about growth in visitors from other faiths? People from other religions. You mentioned the idea of you're able to access because you don't really know the religion. You don't ask them for the religion. But what do you estimate the growth was? If it's 230% for the Muslim from your ability to access it, how do you rate the growth in the non-Muslim population? How many percentage-wise, more or less?
Percentage-wise, I have to calculate the percentage, but before 9/11, we estimated that about 40,000 visitors came from other faiths. And after 9/11, through informal surveys that we have done, we estimate about 250,000 visitors are coming from people of other faith, basically.
So over 600% increase.
That's over a 600% increase.
So the increase in Muslim traffic has been 230%. So over 200%, basically, from 6,500 to 15,000.
Yes.
And then non-Muslim traffic seems to have gone from 40,000 to a quarter million, which is about just over 620%.
That is in messages, and this is actual visitors that we are counting. The overall growth that I showed you was about over 700%. That's the total growth, Muslims and non-Muslims combined.
Okay.
So we feel that these are, of course, very challenging times for us. But at the same time, there is an opportunity where people are learning about Islam from an objective perspective. And this was our idea, basically, that we wanted to give information about Islam from a Muslim perspective. Of course, various media organizations are doing a significant job in terms of giving knowledge about Islam. You have been showing the PBS documentary, for example, that was done about the historical context of how Islam grew. And there are several programs like that that have been presented in mainstream media. But we feel it is important for people to understand Islam from Muslims themselves, and also get a holistic view of Islam, not just a theological view of Islam, but a comprehensive view of Islam from the aspect of deen. Deen, we say, is the way of life, and this is our way of life, and this is what we want to share with people, that this is our way of life, where we have a very comprehensive approach in giving information to people about Islam.
Now, one of the questions I would like to ask then is that generally the kind of questions that you receive, do you find that questioners are more antagonistic, or you find this, generally, I mean, obviously you do find that people will be a downright rude and people will be absolutely, charming and sweet, but I mean, generally, I mean, or is it more spirit of inquiry from your experience?
The majority of the inquiries that we get are, I believe, genuine inquiries where people are actually searching for answers about various things.
And how do they consider your responses? How do they, after answering? Generally, how do they respond? Do you find that some say, well, you are very biased in what you are saying, or generally they find that, thank you for the information, it's what I needed?
The majority of the comments that we get, they are very positive comments. We do get, of course, comments from people that we are biased, and we get criticized from Muslims and from non-Muslims on both sides.
I'm sure more from the Muslims.
either way. That is giving us an opportunity, I think, to make sure that we are walking in the middle path over here.
Yes.
We want that is our objective.
Yeah.
So everyone, of course, cannot be happy with all of the information that we're projecting, and we will have different arguments on both sides. But this is the power, I think, of the internet, not just in Islamicity, but overall. I think that this is giving us an opportunity to make sure that there's more awareness about Islam.
Okay. Could you perhaps take us to the site? And
absolutely.
So we can have a look at Muhammad Abdul Alim, will take us to the CAO of Islamicity, who's here with us this evening. And of course, quite a bit of information you require about the cause. In fact, the cause is what do you call it? What do you say? What do you do on
the global Muslim e-community?
In the Nabori, what do you call our cause? You go in cyberspace to access our program?
Yes, it is on e-learning channel, and I'll show you where all of that where all of that is.
Okay.
In some cases, the browser is a little bit off, so it does not show you the exact picture. But nonetheless, this is the main site. When you come to Islamicity, we have a highlight section where we take either news items or various items that we highlight. So, for example, this is a news item about a 21-year-old U.S. citizen who was gunned down in Ramallah. This is a current event news item. Or you can go to Mosque Design in the USA. This is an article about various mosques within the U.S., how they have come across with various designs and so on. So someone can go and look at this article. On the right-hand side, you were talking about the news. This is where we have all the news items. I think I went to the wrong place, but let me go to the main page here.
So, so at first glance, you are able to have access to whichever avenue you want to go to. I
mean, exactly, these are different channels. So you have news and analysis on one side, yeah. Where we gather news from all over the world, and then we have a multimedia section where we have audio or video that is being presented, we also have our bazaar products, etc., and yes. Then we have various community services, whether it's a discussion board or chat room, etc., where people can post comments on various items, or they can take a poll on various current issues that are going on.
Now, current one is War and Peace. War or Peace?
War or Peace, that's a survey that we're doing about what do people feel the best solution for this crisis may be. Then we have Quran and Sunnah, the example of the Prophet. We have a radio channel where we have an extensive collection of audio material online. Yeah. We also have the Cyber TV channel where we have a collection of video material online. Okay. We have about over 3,000 hours of audio and video material available online that anyone could access. And we have our regular channels on the left-hand side that show you the different functions that are available also. One important function I wanted to point out, for example, this is in our media or in our search, you can select whether you want to search in the Quran or in the mosque section or media section. Let's say I want to search in the media section, and I'll type out, I want to see if there's any media on Jesus. And it will go and search the entire library, and it will present to you whatever material we have out there.
Whether
audio, video, or whatever on Jesus. And here you can see it came up with 48 clips that it found on Jesus. Whether Jesus, Prophet Islam, was Jesus divine, divinity of Jesus, and so on. These are various programs that we have. And of course, you can also see we have an entire collection of Sadullah Khan's audio and video material that you have out there. We were talking about this program itself, Islam Culture and Civilization. We have the last session, not the last session, the before that.
Yes.
In 1 week, we'll have, we're about a week behind on this, but we'll have all of the sessions available.
So we are today on session 9. So right. Do you have the first 7 you already have on there?
First session, 7 sessions are already here. That's why you see session 7 and 6 and 5.
Yeah, well, the
and
topic
so
itself and the content.
And all the topics and everything that are out there. Yes. And of course, along with that, what we can present is you wrote a book,
yes.
Also Dimensions of Islam. Mm. So we're promoting that book. Mm. Anyone who wants to does a search on Sadullah Khan, for example, will be presented with all of your audio video material that we have online, and also if the book or any other related material that we want to show at that time.
Is there any other programs on regarding academic programs that you have? Is this the first one that you're having on or from Cal State University?
This is the first distant learning program that we have made available, and we're looking forward to working with, of course, Cal State Dominguez Hills in the future, and making sure we can provide various types of programming through Islamicity also.
So anyone who has missed any of the past programs, of course, they could view it on.
They can view it. They can view it online. Exactly.
Yeah. In Cyber
TV. Although Cal State Dominguez Hills does stream live, but they're not archived. So the service that we are providing, in addition to what Cal State is already doing, is making sure that there's an archive of these programs. And of course, we're using the streaming technology, the media technology that we have, real media technology, where someone can click on it and stream the entire program, basically.
Okay. Now, coming back, thank you very much for all the presentation, both the this PowerPoint or slide presentations you had there, and as well as the going on to the site itself. A few questions that I just feel that maybe we need to look at is that what role do you think, besides just being a source of information, which you are right now, specifically after 9/11, there's so much misunderstanding, there's so much ignorance in some way. on the one hand, so much disinformation or misinformation, and sometimes even misrepresentation by Muslims themselves of Islam, and which can be more damaging. How do you see your role in that, you know, quagmire of trying to inform, trying to entertain, still, you know, be a source of truth information?
It is a delicate balance to keep, of course. But the role we see ourselves in is that we are in the business of providing information. We provide a very broad perspective of Islam. We are not coming up with our own perspective on Islam. That's why when you go, you will see various scholars. Scholars' opinion out there. Some.
Do you have non-Muslim scholars as well? Non-Muslim scholars on Islam.
Absolutely, we have non-Muslims lectures, etc. For example, John Esposito or Canon Armstrong, etc. All of those lectures are available online, where we believe they add value to the content that we have out there.
Yeah. The other question that I have is that you mentioned early on that before September 11th, after September 11th, tremendous increase, and initially there was a outcry of people disgust and disappointment and so on, and later off it cooled down. Presently, what is the situation right now? How because in some way you receive traffic, people who are in mosques or in churches, synagogues, have a live audience to whom they refer and who they are in touch with. Whereas in your case, it's a continuous thing, it's all the time, it's online, it's, they're all the time. So, could you give me some information as to what's the situation right now?
We are directly tied in with the current geopolitical situation that is happening around us. We see a spike in usage of internet as these different events take place. For example, after 9/11, there was a huge rush from people to understand about Islam. When the operation started in Afghanistan, the bombing started in Afghanistan, again we saw different types of emotions coming up. From the Muslim perspective, people were upset that the innocent people are dying, for example. That was the main theme that was coming across. From the non-Muslim perspective, there was a different theme coming about that they had to defend themselves. Now, with the current crisis in the Middle East, we see a huge interest and debate. What is going on? Who is to blame? Why is all of this happening? What are the solutions out there? Whether people are talking intellectually, or people are just talking through emotion. All of that is coming out, and of course we see our job as more from the perspective of making sure people are aware with the different types of information that is out there. For example, the 21-year-old Muslim U.S. citizen who was shot down in Ramallah, that news did not come about in mainstream media. We got this news, and we made sure that people are aware of this information. She was an American citizen who was shot in Ramallah, who was crossing the street with her son. These are things that we feel that people need to know about. So this is the added information that we're giving.
We
to
have
people.
A question here from Danny. Thank you for the question, Danny. It reads: thank you for your informative lecture, Professor Khan. My question to your guest is, how is Islamicity different from thousands of other religious websites, Islamic or other? How is it? The question is, how is Islamicity different from thousands of other Islamic or other religious websites? Right. What's unique?
Interesting question. An important question also. If you do a search on any of the search engines on Islam, you'll come up with thousands of different web pages available on Islam. We feel that our uniqueness is this concept of community. We're not in the business of building just website. We're in the business of building a community. And we're in the business of making sure that people can understand us from that community aspect. That is, I think, one of the most important features that distinguishes us from any of the other websites. You will find other websites that are related to, of course, various types of issues and organizations and so on. There are various mosques and organizations who have their own websites. There are.
Are you linked to any organization? Are you on the umbrella of any organization?
That is one of our strengths. We say that we are fiercely independent. We are not supported by any organization. We are homegrown right here in the U.S. We are totally independent. We come up with our own funding sources through our bazaar activities and various commerce activities that we are that we have going on. And that's how we sustain ourselves. But that is one of the main things that I think distinguishes us from other websites, is that we have a very holistic approach. Yes.
And also that you are based in America and you consider yourself as part of the American landscape.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that is a very unique thing that is happening, where this site, which is now considered one of the largest sites for Islamic information, was developed here in the U.S. It was not developed in Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Egypt, or any of the other Muslim countries. It was developed here. This is where the internet was developed, and it is very logical that information from about Islam is also being developed right here. These are ways, I think, where Muslims, especially in America, have a unique role to play, where they are in a position to influence. 50% of our visitors come from outside the U.S. currently. And we are influencing people, you know, right for, you know,
by, from by, through information.
Through information, you know, and by giving them, you know, various types of perspectives about things that are happening around us.
We have another comment here. I think it's rather a comment than a question here on the internet. According to Computer Industry Almanac, CIA. CIA?
Yes.
Central Intelligence. This is Computer Industry Almanac. 150 million people are online in the U.S. from a population of 278 million. That's 54%.
Yes, I think that's a better number. My percentage was off. I said probably 80 million. This is probably a much better estimate.
Almost double the movement.
In my graph, I showed that there are about 60%,
yeah,
people in the U.S. Yeah. have access to the internet.
So this is quite close.
So this would be much closer to that.
Yeah, unbelievable. Tell me one thing I'd like to ask. Were you ever cited by other CNN or CBS? I mean, were there any made reference to you? Were you ever cited by other by major networks or so? I mean, acknowledged in some way or so?
We have been acknowledged by various organizations, mainstream media organizations. We received the Yahoo Best Site Award, the top 100 sites, basically, that Yahoo picks. We were selected among those top 100 sites. Various media organizations have listed us as Site of the Month. Public Broadcasting System has selected us
PBS.
As Site. PBS has selected us as Site of the Month. And I think the other unique thing that is happening, even among media organizations, is that they can easily find us.
Mm-hmm.
And they can go online, they can do searches, and we show up on all of the search engines. And we are contacted on a continual basis by media organizations, not just on what we are doing online, but perspectives about Islam. And what we do is either we will talk to the media ourselves, or we will find other experts and liaison for the media so that they have the proper perspective available to them. This is the role of the internet. It's a collaborative medium.
Mm.
It is a medium where people can coordinate activities. It is a medium through which people can efficiently make use of resources available to them. So it increases our overall efficiency in terms of, you know, providing the correct information.
Thank you very much, Brother Muhammad Ali. We're almost out of time. I think we just have a minute left, maybe. Just to recap some of the things that we have dealt with today, we have dealt with our first guest, Munir Sheikh, who is pursuing his PhD in Islamic Studies at UCLA. We looked at centers of learning as beacons of civilization, and looking particularly at the role of mosque schools and in Medina, Cairo, Timbuktu, Cordova, and so on in other parts of the world, with specific emphasis this evening on Timbuktu in West Africa and, of course, Baghdad in Iraq. Then we dealt with 10 outstanding scholars, which was Nafisa bint Hassan, a great-granddaughter of the Prophet she was. Then Jabir ibn Hayyan, the father of modern chemistry, Muhammad al-Khwarizmi, after whom algorithm was named, Ibn Sina, Ibn Rushd, al-Khayyam at least, Ibn Rushd, Jalaluddin al-Rumi, Ibn Battuta, and of course our very own Nobel laureate, Ahmad Zuhail. We looked at some of the Islamic contribution to English and Spanish language, a few of them from a variety of words that are still being used. And also we looked at the conclusion of the book World Civilizations, where we dealt with the measure of Islamic scientific achievement and contribution in various fields of science. And finally, we conclude with Accessing Islam with Muhammad Aleen, the CEO of Islamicity. Thank you very much for being here. We'll see you next week, Session 10, Islam in America via Africa. Thank you.